It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Lots of fun, lots of interest, things going on. But before we get into all of that, I want to start off with the sad. Today is the day they laid Rich Trumka at rest. His memorial service was today. And, you know, the labor movement lost a giant. Lost somebody who, I thought was important. Somebody who I thought was, well, a solid leader. Somebody who was, as I've said before, somebody who was on the right side of history when it mattered. Was in the right mode in the right moment. And his leadership's going to be missed. I think back to, as I talked about over the last several days, the moments that I spent time on. I had a number of opportunities to sit down and interview the man. The idea that this was somebody who grasped what history was, who grasped the consequences of not reaching out to all workers. And I have great hope for Liz Shuler as she moves into his position and moves forward. But I thought it was a sad day and one that should be remembered. And going forward, you know, the hope now becomes that we reunite around the idea that the right to collective bargaining, the right to organize, the right to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, fundamental to who we are and what we do and what we should have in this country. I mean, the sad reality and the numbers we've talked about over the last couple of days, you know, the CEO class, you know, lining their pockets, you know, like 1,300% more over the last 40 years than the working class, who saw like an 18% raise over that same period. And you look at what I was sold as a kid, that idea that you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead, that your work mattered and that your work would be rewarded. All of that stuff came out of a strong labor movement. And the hope is we recommit around those ideas and we get something pushed through. It's that simple. And thoughts go out to Rich Trumka's family and all that. Now, today, another a sad day, more people getting sick. We see these numbers coming out of Texas, out of Florida, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, all the places that were solidly Trump folks. I've been in this place for a little while, but I finally come to the reality that it's time to stop treating these people nicely. It's time to really stop protecting the dim. It's time to really stop protecting those who really don't know what they claim to know. I've been watching these people with just the loud mouths and the obnoxious rhetoric. What's amazing to me, and this comes back to a couple of things, that the people who, and you, I think we all know them, the people who were screaming about, you know, we live in a time of participation trophies, and there's all this unearned self-esteem, and that, you know, people are just too, well, they think they know too much. Well, we're in that. And I've been watching this play out in school boards all across the country. I mean, it's really insane as you're watching this illegitimate spawn of the Tea Party These angry Karens, these zombie Karens running to the school boards, complaining about the fact that their little Precious has to wear a mask. And I've had enough of it. There's a moment where, and I've believed that we've done the participation trophy stuff and the unearned self-esteem for too long. And the people who complain about it the most seem to be the ones who are the ones who got the participation trophies and the unearned self-esteem. These are people who barely got out of high school biology telling us about, you know, about vaccines that they know nothing about. And yet what's interesting is all of them have been vaccinated. Not against COVID, but about everything else beforehand. So they've been vaccinated, they lived through it, and now they're claiming that some bizarre cuke stuff, I don't know, Bill Gates, zombie virus, I don't know. I've stopped keeping up with the crazy. But here's what I know. 40% of all hospitalizations, all new hospitalizations due to COVID are happening in Florida and Texas. Mississippi today announced that they're going to be out of hospital beds soon. That they are actually setting up hospitals, field hospitals, inside of parking garages. In August, in freaking Mississippi. Now, let this sink in for a second. You're going to take these parking garages, you're going to turn them into little hospitals, little triage centers, little field hospitals. I'm sure you're going to be able to try and blow some kind of air, some kind of cooling system, kind of something, into places where people are going to be on ventilators. And why not? Because it doesn't really matter what the air quality is, because they're going to be on ventilators. All something that we could have avoided. Florida, as I said yesterday, they've purchased some new mobile morgues because they're expecting more death. Oklahoma, they have now sounded the alarm. They're running out of hospital beds. Now, remember at the very beginning to all of this? Remember at the very beginning when what they were saying is we have to control the number of people who are coming to the hospital. We can't have our system overrun because, you know, while we're losing the people on the COVID side, all of the other people, we're going to be losing them too. People who are suffering from heart attacks, people, cancer, you know, go down the line. We're not going to be able to meet the needs. We don't have the infrastructure for it. We don't have the ability to keep up. Well, this is where we're heading. And now we're heading into school. Heading into the school season. Florida's been back to school 2 days. Two. Already one of the school districts, Palm Beach County, they're asking 440 students to stay home to quarantine. 2 days in, 440. They've already got 51 students and faculty with confirmed cases. Already 2 days in. And here's the thing. This is the ones they know about. It's crazy. And what you've got is just this really bizarre moment where there are so many people who think they know so much. Well, not. And we're all going to suffer for this. And look, I've taken the position that I don't care. If they get it and they die, not a tear. Good. Bye. The problem still is the healthcare system for the rest of us. And the fact that once this virus jumps the vaccine, we got to go back through this whole exercise again. Or what ends up happening is we just make it the new crazy normal. Where you go, you know what? Bunch of people got sick, bunch of people died. That's how it is. That's normal now. And remember, these are the people these are the people who were afraid that, that some world government was going to come and extinguish people. You would think, you know, if there was a way to protect yourself, you'd try and figure it out. And I know I've gotten emails from people going, you know, Rick, you know, calling them stupid isn't helpful. I know. But what else do you do? How else do you bring people around to the idea that they should protect themselves? And by them not protecting themselves, they're actually making all of us less safe. And I know people have different beliefs. I hear this nonsense all the time. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe we've allowed too many people too much access to spread lies and misinformation. And look, I'm somebody who believes in more speech as opposed to less. But I think on some level, you have to be held accountable for the words that you say. Much like you can't yell fire in a theater without being held accountable, I don't think you should be allowed to knowingly spread misinformation. You know, like drink this silver stuff. This will protect you from everything. Today, the fourth anniversary of the murder of Heather Heyer. 4 years ago today, beautiful 32-year-old woman, mowed down. Her death shocked the world because it showed the face of hatred, the white supremacist movement in this country. She was killed by a 20-year-old Ohio Nazi. Now he's going to spend probably the rest of his life in jail. And good. I was thinking about this today. In a number of states across the country, you've got the Republicans who have pushed through these anti-protester vehicle laws, where in some states you can now run people over if they're protesting in front of you because, hey, you got to get to the Starbucks, or hey, you got to get to the donut shop. They might close. There are laws now that say you can run people over. I got to wonder, would this 20-year-old Nazi have been held accountable with those laws on the books? Is this the future? And you know, 4 years ago today when this beautiful young woman was killed, we heard the fine people on both sides. You know, fine people on both sides. That was kind of the punchline to the whole thing. And the one thing that the Unite the Right rally did then is it united people across this country. To kill. Whether it was Heather Heyer, whether it was Brian Sicknick on January 6th, or whether it's the more than 600,000 people who have lost their lives to COVID, because we've got people who, well, we just can't, oh, I don't know, follow simple directions. And the thing that's crazy to me is when you look at what's come out of the former guys movement of hatred, it's still there. Like there are people who firmly believe, and I have somebody who believes tomorrow Donald Trump's going to be reinstated. Told me flat out, tomorrow's going to happen. You just watch. There are other people saying, no, we've moved that date. And it's all on the guise of violence and hatred. And it comes back to 4 years ago today, that Unite the Right rally, riot, whatever you want to call it. And then all of the other shows of force that they did throughout the Trump years, whether it was invading a state capitol over mask mandates, or it was, in February of 2020, that whatever rally lobby day they claimed, where you had all these armed people showing up in their dress gear, that I said was a show of force. They were showing us what they're capable of. That was a mobilization to show power. And the world wasn't shocked enough. Because here's where my fear is. My fear is we've forgotten all of this. because you got Donald Trump coming out right now saying that they know who the person who shot Ashley Babbitt is. They're trying to make that treasonous woman a martyr. They know who he is. And they're going to spin it. They are going to spin this, and it is going to be dangerous. And I'm not sure where it takes us. Because the more I'm hearing from contacts inside of this, the person who shot Ashley Babbitt was an African-American police officer. This is going to be, and Trump knows this, which is why they're playing coy with it, which is why they're playing with it, which is why they're saying that she was murdered and they know who he is, which is why they're threatening. Because this is what the right does. They need to ramp up maximum fear. Maximum fear of violence, maximum fear of the unknown, maximum fear of the other, maximum fear of, you know, Bill Gates. He's got a chip in there. And, you know, I heard a comedian the other day go, why would Bill Gates want to chip you to find out anything about you? Bill Gates doesn't care about you because clearly you don't care about yourself. So I'm looking at this moment and I'm going, we're heading down the wrong paths. And the next couple of months, you know, do we have to do this again? And the answer is yes. We're going to have to live through another massive crisis. And the question is where does this bring us? Is this a moment where government is going to have to step forward and start mandating this stuff before you can go into certain places? I don't know. I'm generally not someone who's in favor of those kind of mandates. But wow, when common sense is right in front of you, and you still choose, when you still make the choice to make the wrong one. I used to say, and this is where my mind's always been, I used to say, you have the right to make the wrong choice because that's your problem. This now affects me and everybody that I love and the country that I love. You got to do the right thing, man. Anyway, got lots to get to today. Infrastructure. Some labor stuff that's just driving me crazy. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1955. That was the day Teamsters organizer, 28-year-old William Grammy, was kidnapped and beaten. Grammy had arrived in Sebastopol, California, to help organize about 350 workers in local canneries, drying plants, and fruit sheds. The Teamsters had been on campaign footing for months in an attempt to win union recognition, higher wages, better working conditions, and benefits. They had lost a union representation election the previous fall after Sebastopol apple growers moved quickly to lay off union supporters. By January, cannery workers at Oscar Hall & Sons voted for union representation. The workers at Barlow Company would vote against the union just 2 months later. But by early August, the strike wave hit. Workers walked off the job at the Sebastopol Cooperative Cannery. More at seven other area canneries joined them on strike in the days that followed. Grammy would later testify that he had heard reports weeks earlier of a grower threatening to have him killed within 3 hours should any strike actually take place. During the strike that would ultimately prove victorious, three men kidnapped Grammy outside the union's hall. He was driven along a rural road, tied to a pole, gagged, and beaten with a bicycle chain. Left for dead, he was found the next day and hospitalized immediately. But the union and the strikers remained undeterred. Before the strike was over, scab trucks attempting to haul apples to market were vandalized and burned, and scab drivers were beaten. 8 months later, the apple industry finally came to the negotiating table. By May of 1956, apple growers signed with the Teamsters. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters @laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I said yesterday, looking forward to moving these infrastructure bills forward for a bunch of reasons. Transportation, moving to electric vehicles, remaking our economy, leaving something for our children in the future. So many opportunities to do good things. Maybe a little renewable energy, maybe move us in that direction. Because after all, the UN did say that recent report, it's code red for humanity. And I don't know if you've noticed, but there are 107 wildfires going on in this country right now. Texas, California, Montana are literally burning, which is why we need to do something. We need to do it now. And here to share some thoughts on the infrastructure bills, I've asked Austin Keiser to come talk with us. Austin is the assistant to the National President of Government Affairs at the National Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW. Austin, thanks for taking time for us.
I appreciate it, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into all the wires and all the transportation stuff and all the infrastructure stuff, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the passing of Rich Trumka today. His service was today. I know you worked for him. Thoughts?
Yeah, no, Rich Trumka was a great leader at Titan. I grew up in coal country myself, and I grew up as a kid watching him on television, you know, locking arms, wearing camouflage, being militant, out fighting for workers' rights. It gave me a lot of passion for the labor movement as a small child. You know, you got three channels growing up out there, and he seemed to be on the news every night out there fighting for workers. So always been a hero of mine. And, you know, as you just mentioned, I got the opportunity to work for him. I was Central Labor Council leader in Southern Ohio, and he tapped me to come in and be the state director for the National AFL-CIO in Ohio, then the Midwest region director. And it was during the fights right after the Tea Party, you know, sort of took over the Midwest, and just so many hours. I can't even count how many hours we spent in cars riding around the Midwest, going from fight to fight, from Wisconsin to Indiana, Ohio, Senate Bill 5. Just a great trooper and somebody I've stayed close to even since I came back to the IBEW. Just a great mentor, and he loved to see young people coming up in the labor movement. He loved to coach us along, and just gave me and a lot of other people a lot of great opportunities and a lot of education. So somebody will always be dear to my heart, and somebody I'll do my best to carry on his legacy.
Yeah, I mean, from this point forward now, it's we're going to have to pick up that vision and move forward. And we're in this most interesting time because I would argue Joe Biden's probably the most pro-labor president, at least of my lifetime. And there's something of an opportunity to get some stuff done, maybe in this this big infrastructure bill, but you know, hopefully down the road as well. So now's the time where labor's got to come back together and unite and move, pick up Rich's mantle and move on.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We something he was very passionate about was energy. Obviously, he came out of the coal miners, so. But he was like us. He realized that things are changing, that climate change is real. You know, the real things went out there. Our members are the first ones to go into storms. We're on the tip of watching climate change. These super storms, these major events, they cause power outages and major devastation, and our power linemen are the first to go in before most other first responders to make sure the area is safe and electrified. Hospitals have their electricity back. And so it's definitely not something we're hiding from. It's been difficult. You know, to look at how you transition, and that's been a tough bridge for us. We don't want to leave workers behind in the process, and I think we've made a lot of progress. And in this bill, we certainly made a lot of progress because President Biden is such a pro-union president.
I mean, the fact that he got this through, and I've been saying for a while, we've been talking about infrastructure for a very long time in this country, and I've been pointing out the fact that the I-35 bridge collapse was 14 years ago this month, and we were talking about it for probably several years before that, how we needed a big investment in our future. So as someone in the building trades, you've got to be looking at both plans, especially the hard infrastructure plan, as an opportunity to get people back to work, to create good family-sustaining jobs, and to rebuild the future of this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so much in this infrastructure package. And you know, I want to hedge it with this. I mean, it's not sort of a perfect what we would have exactly written, but we have to negotiate with Republicans here. And that's a tough thing to do. And I got to say that the end product is impressive. I was quite honestly surprised at how far the White House and the Senate Democrats were able to get us with Republicans on this. I mean, we're talking $73 billion for power infrastructure. There's tons of funding in here for renewables, for electric vehicles, for carbon capture, for keeping nuclear power plants online, which is so important to the baseload power. We can't decarbonize without that. That same report you just mentioned, says that very directly. It's got to be a key component. And we represent workers at, I think, 89 of the 93 reactors in this country. So, a big issue for us, a big issue for our members. So, look, there's weatherization assistance in here. There's public transit, there's airports. You've seen the bill. There's just so much in here that's good. And we're talking record-breaking investment levels. But, it left a little on the table. And we're gonna try to figure that out later. For instance, we didn't get prevailing wages on the broadband infrastructure. That's a giant investment. And, it's $42 billion. And that's substantial. But what we do know is there are going to be processes, there's going to be where these money's allocated, there's going to be administrative functions here, rulemaking that the administration is going to be very friendly on. So I think we're going to be able to clean a lot of that up through the administration and through the White House as it's deployed.
No, on the broadband front, it's one of those things that I'm fairly upset about, because we're basically handing corporate America a boatload of money and saying, here, go ahead, here's a gift, is where they should have been making these investments. I'm a believer, and we should be reclaiming our electrical lines, our utilities, our broadband. We should have communities who are able to do this, and we own and control our own destiny on that front.
Yeah, so you have the Tennessee Valley Authority, as an example here. And quite honestly, they've built more fiber optic middle mile broadband than anybody else in the country currently. So it's a dual functionality. So broadband, we hear a lot of it talked about in the context of schools and education and the digital divide. And those things are all very important. Again, kid coming up in Appalachia, I see what, my home community is. It's pretty underserved. But the beauty of it is that these utilities need broadband too. They need fiber optics between their substations. They need it into the meters of homes. If we're going to have a smart grid, it has to be networked and it has to have a communication system attached to it. So there's so many opportunities here of dual purpose that, I think building this thing through utilities is going to make sure it's union. So it's going to take a lot, it's going to, and rural co-ops are playing a big part. Middle Tennessee Electric, for instance, in Tennessee, is probably the biggest builder and service provider now in the entire region, and maybe in the country, for a rural co-op, and they're doing this work union, and it's a great example. So there's new business models that are going to pop up here. We're going to play a little bit of whack-a-mole here, making sure the bad guys don't prevail on us. But I think there's a lot of opportunity, and I think having the White House friends in the White House, it's going to help a lot.
So the other question I have is, there's so much to do. I remember Jerry Brown ran for president in 92 on the platform of he was going to restring all of the wires in the entire country that go into people's homes, because there's some astronomical amount of loss just in transmission for electricity. We've been talking about doing this for ages. Now there's almost an opportunity to do some of it. The question is, do we have enough people who are able to do it? I'm trying to find somebody to just wire a couple of outlets. I don't know how you're going to rewire half the country and do the kind of work that we're talking about going forward with solar and electric vehicles. There are going to be wires coming out of our ears. Do we have enough people to play with those wires?
Well, of course, it takes a while to train a journey level electrician and power lineman, or about a 4-year training program. And we've been screaming this for years. We need, just like any other business or any other industry, anything else, we need market predictability if we're going to invest. We do our workforce training. It's completely industry funded. We don't ask for federal dollars or handouts here. We're not a startup. We've been around since the advent of electricity, training electricians. And our programs are plenty. They're like a bladder. We can take in as many workers as we need. They're built, the structure is built to take in workers, but you're exactly right. Recruitment is hard. And so we're excited about a lot of new initiatives that we're working on. One of them is working with the military. We've been partnering with the White House with the, something Rich was a big champion of, which is, the Veterans Council, Will Attic. I don't know if you know Will Attic.
Sure, but, good friend of the show.
He's doing great work. We've been partnering up and having a lot of conversations on how we get more folks coming from the military, because one, they're ready to go to work, right? They love the community of being in a union after they get out of the military. It's a natural fit for them. And it does away with a lot of social ills that come with that transition. for them. So great opportunities, and it's the most diverse workforce in the country. So it's an automatic sort of plus up for us in that department too, which we've made huge strides on. But you know, it's going to be it's hard. You know, the people, a lot of high schools and universities have not been friendly to blue collar jobs. They've coached people away from them, and we're starting to get some momentum back. And these power liners are making six figures.
No, I know. I know, just to get somebody to come wire an outlet, it ain't cheap.
We're going to need 100,000 more of them, we think, you know, over the next few years. But huge opportunities on the grid, too, in the manufacturing space with the Buy America provisions that are in this bill. You know, we're talking something IBEW does and other unions do, is manufacture wire and transformers and all of these components that are going to go into the grid. It's not just wires, and it's not just sort of the installation.
No, I mean, the jobs that will come from the reverberation effect of just doing some of this stuff is mind-blowing. And it's one of those things where I can't believe that administrations of the past, you know, the former administration, you know, on day one when he took over, I'm saying you should pass a massive infrastructure bill because everybody's for it. And we're now finding out everybody's kind of for it. The polling is in a time when we're so divided on virtually every issue. This one seems to be, well, not so divided.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder about the last administration's strategy there, because they did. They had a huge opportunity to build a very, as populist as he tried to be. It was insane to me that he didn't do infrastructure, because Democrats were sitting there ready to do infrastructure. It would have been a tough negotiation for them, too. But it was a tough negotiation, just like it was for Biden. But it was, we were able to get it done and able to get big things done here. So, yeah, it's insane to me that that they didn't get anything done there, and but a bunch of rhetoric and a bunch of talk and a bunch of banter, but no delivery. So here we are. We're sitting here with on the verge of, anyways. You know, we're one step of, you know, like a quarter of the way there, getting this to the president's desk.
Yeah.
If we're going to measure it, but I think we're well on our way.
As someone who focuses on this like you do, obviously you're the assistant to the international president for government affairs there at the IBEW. You know, what do you see? What do you, if you're the odds broker on this, if you're the odds maker, what do you think the odds of getting one of them or both of them through? Where would you be laying money down?
If I was going to lay money down, I'd say we're going to get both of them done, and I think we're going to get both of them done later this fall, and it's going to be. I would give it a 90% chance here. I think this was the biggest hurdle of the process, was getting, the split Senate, to get those 10 Republican senators on board. From here on out, we just need simple majorities. And, you know, the House, of course, is they're posturing, and rightfully so. They want good democratic principles and priorities incorporated into the reconciliation package, into the budget package. And, you know, Republicans knew that, and still 19 of them voted for this. Bill, they knew that it was going to, right behind this was going to come a purely Democratic bill that was going to have some Democratic principles in it. Now, you've got Manchin, you've got Sinema, you've got some moderates there, I think, that made some promises that, you know, they won't revisit in reconciliation things that they negotiated on, you know, the things that we see enumerated in the infrastructure package. But I still think we're going to get some really, really big, really bold things. I'm hoping we can get it on that Build Back Better, that leaves a legacy that's something like the New Deal. I think it's going to be a little smaller than that, right? But and it's an opportunity to reshape some key components of the country, especially electricity.
Yeah, I mean, the reality, Austin, this is an opportunity to reshape the next 100 years of this country. We have the ability to, you know, reshape travel and transit. There's talk of, you know, of extending transit lines so that I can get on a train somewhere and get somewhere else where maybe I don't have to have my car. Or maybe if I get an electrical vehicle, maybe I can have a recharging station. Maybe we set up the network that we need. You know, maybe we transform gas stations into electric charging stations. Maybe we have the ability to do this. To me, this is really exciting stuff, because this is all the kind of stuff I was reading about as a kid in sci-fi magazines and books, that we're going to be able to maybe get to those places.
Yeah, no, it's look, I mean, you heard President Biden talk, like at the State of the Union address, talking about the IBEW is going to install these 500,000 stations, right? And he's lived up to that. We've had so many meetings with the automakers, with President Stevenson in the White House, you're talking about how we do this, not just build it, not just give away money to corporations, but to build this with union workers. And so, I mean, that focus is just so obvious. And so it just sort of underpins everything that we're trying to accomplish here. And the progressives in the House, you know, they want the same thing, right? They want really strong labor provisions in here, not just progressives. I mean, there's a lot of people who do, including one or two Republicans, honestly, in the House that are strong on labor standards, supported the PRO Act, for instance. So, look, we're going to get as much of the PRO Act as we can. I think in reconciliation, you know, the Byrd rule, which, you know, I think is an antiquated rule that, you know, probably ought to be thrown in the garbage, but it is what it is. If they live by the Byrd rule, it's going to be, you know, we can't get everything in the PRO Act in there. But there are a lot of things that create penalties and provisions and enforcement of laws that are very, very much in bounds there. And that gives us the opportunity to grow union density as we grow the size of the market. We grow density with it, not just.
There'll be some economic things that get in there. But, you know, for a company like Amazon, that doesn't really matter. The last minute here I want to spend, you know, basically as a recruiting opportunity because, you know, you guys are going to need a lot of people to string up wires. And I say all the time, our apprenticeship programs, all the building trades apprenticeship programs are fantastic. They're pathways to good, solid middle class wage jobs. And more importantly, it's an earn as you learn thing. You're not going to be saddled with a lifetime of student loan debt and all of that. You know, make the pitch of how this is going to play out for the next generation of workers coming out of schools now.
Yeah, look, I'm a journeyman electrician by trade, right? I went through the apprenticeship and came through the rank and file, so I believe it. I bleed it here. But you know, look, there's no better opportunity. I mean, you see kids going to college, getting degrees, you know, because corporate America is telling them they need a bachelor's degree to rent cars at down at the local rental, you know, car rental company. It's absurd, right? They're putting so much of a burden, a financial burden on workers to put them to work. This is a way to shift back the economy to the point where employers have to invest in their workers, right? And we've been doing that in the trades for years. I mean, outside the United States military, we're the largest vocational trainer, us and the other trades combined, in the entire world. So huge opportunities. We're talking sophisticated training. We're talking career paths with pensions and healthcare, but things you don't find in a lot of other sectors of the economy. These are just excellent jobs with opportunities to move up. The volume of workers we need, you know, we're going to need tons of foremen and project estimators and folks. So the pathway's there. I mean, even if you only want to roll up your sleeves and do the hard, you know, in the ditch work or up on the pole work for a few years, there's going to be so many places to land here. The market's getting bigger and the opportunities are there. And I'd strongly recommend to anybody, and I would strongly recommend parents coach their kids there because it's a great way to save their pocketbook too.
I've been trying.
Yeah, look, our doors are open and we're ready. I mean, we need folks across the board, not just in the electrical trade, but across the building trades.
Austin, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. I'd love to have you back and talk about some of those opportunities. I know you guys are on the cutting edge of green technology, of the new electric revolution. I'd love to have you come back and share some of the work that you guys are doing.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Love to take a deep dive on any of that with you anytime.
Good stuff, Austin. Appreciate the time. Austin Keyser, international assistant to the international president of government affairs there at the IBEW. Check out their website, IBEW.org. We'll get links out at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day that the chorus girls of the Ziegfeld Follies formed a union. They called their organization the Chorus Equity Association. The Ziegfeld Follies were the hottest ticket on Broadway during the early 1900s. The show was most famous for their chorus girls in elaborate costumes, bedecked with feathers and sparkles. In 1919, performers on Broadway as well as Chicago were standing up for fairer wages and better treatment on the job. The Actors' Equity Association's contract had expired, and the actors demanded a fair contract. The producers banded together into the Producing Managers Association. Actors and producers faced off. The actors held a meeting and decided not to go on stage unless the contract was settled. Membership in the union swelled. 12 shows in New York alone were canceled. When Florence Ziegfeld, the head of the Ziegfeld Follies, joined the producers group, the chorus girls took this as a bad sign. They decided it was time they, too, joined the union movement. A former chorus girl named Marie Dressler was elected the first union president. The chorus girls joined the striking actors for a march down Broadway. The Ziegfeld performers formally went out on strike, and the curtain fell on the Follies. Chicago theaters also went dark. In all, 37 productions were shut down in the two cities. Finally, on September 7th, the strike was settled and the Follies returned. In 1955, Chorus Equity merged with the Actors Equity Association. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'll tell you, it's one of those things that I've been talking about for, well, probably all 16 years I've been doing this show, that you get those construction jobs, those building trades jobs. Those are solid wage, family-sustaining jobs with excellent benefit, retirement, all kinds of stuff. It's the kind of economy we want to have. It's the kind of economy, heavily unionized, make sure people have rights on the job, make sure that they're paid a reasonable wage. They're great jobs. And as you said, look, some of the linemen, they're making six figures. That's the kind of economy that you want to build. You don't want to build an economy off of people making $2.83 an hour, or 86, or whatever the Pennsylvania state minimum wage for restaurant workers is. You want to build an economy on high-wage jobs, not exploitable, desperate, low-wage jobs. And sadly, what the pandemic showed us is we've got way too many of those kind of jobs. We gave nice titles, essential, called them heroes, all that stuff, only to underpay them, cheat them, and now we find it's getting even worse. I'm here to share some thoughts on just how bad the inequality has gotten in America. And their ongoing series on inequality in America. I've asked Marcus Barham to come talk with us. Marcus is the special project editor over at Capital in Maine. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Rick. I'm in a car, so sorry if it's. I hope it's quiet enough for you.
So here I'm looking at this story that you guys just put out. Story of a school teacher who, you know, again. You know, we're a lot of people beating up on school teachers because they don't want to go rushing back into an unsafe classroom. And you look at a lot of states across the country, these are really poverty wage jobs and we're paying people poverty wages and entrusting them with our most valuable resource, our kids, the future of this country. It seems insane.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was a school teacher in New York in the early 90s, and I had to work extra jobs. Just to do anything beyond pay the rent. And I talk to teachers now in New York, where they're a little better paid, but especially in states like Florida, which has one of the lowest salaries for teachers of any state. And they all have to do extra jobs. Like you see in the story, in that example, they both teachers, one older and one a younger teacher, both had to work extra jobs just to bring an income. So they're working two or three jobs just to keep up, and they're doing, like you said, the most important job in the world.
Yeah, and as you point out in your piece, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they found out of all of the OECD countries, the U.S. had the largest. This is your words, the largest salary gap between teachers and other workers with comparable training. And hey, we're number one.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's kind of stunning. I mean, it's not too surprising when you look at other examples, but a lot of it is that even though teachers are unionized in the U.S., the unions don't have that much power, and so they don't have much clout. And you see it overseas where the unions are, much more powerful, especially teachers' unions, and they can, demand and get those salaries they deserve, where people who graduate from the best schools in Germany and in France and other places go into teaching. They don't go onto Wall Street. I mean, some do. They don't They don't automatically, you know, go into business, but or law, but they go into teaching and it's a respected job.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
And so, you know, I've had a bunch of people over the years say, well, the reason that it's not a respected job is because overwhelmingly it's a job done by women. Is that something you've heard, something you believe, something you think?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a sexist element there. I mean, in terms of like, that, you know, generally teachers are considered women, or that's the job you think of, is it female teachers. And I'm sure that's a factor. Another factor is, I think, yeah, for many years, it was a job for slightly educated women who served as a central function. It's like, okay, we have these, you know, kids you got to teach. It's not the most important. You know, you don't have to be super trained to do it. Even though the challenges have increased exponentially. I remember when I was teaching, you know, you had to deal with, I was teaching up in Harlem, and there were all kinds of issues that you had to deal with, be sort of a social worker at the same time. Things that you didn't really happen, you know, when teachers first started to, public schools first started to, you know, open up in the start of the century and in the 19th century, and when it was almost all women, and they were just taking whoever was barely trained or out of high school, or not even high school, somebody who at least could competently lead a group of kids. So the needs, you know, haven't been, they're not being met with the salaries that equal those demands.
No, and again, it comes back down to, I would argue, bargaining power. A lot of states have laws that limit what teachers' unions can bargain over, and you know, again, they play between the rules, and that's been a huge win for conservatives over the years, is limiting what unions can bargain over and what teachers, especially teachers' union and public sector workers, are able to bargain over, to where it's almost to the point where,
right,
what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, look what happened in Wisconsin. I was just reading about that, doing some research today, and you forget how, you remember in 2011, Scott Walker's bill, which completely undercut public sector workers.
Yep.
And most of it was aimed at teachers. I mean, that teachers made up like a large component of those public sector workers. And their salaries went down.
Plummeted.
Because all of a sudden they had to pay for their own benefits.
No, so I was there. I spent, yeah, you know, 10 days sleeping on the granite floor, or the marble floor.
There you go.
You know, in February in Wisconsin, you know, and they did. They rammed it through like thieves in the night. And it was never anything he ran on. But boy, you know, he sure stuck it to those people. And now Wisconsin, which had been at the top end of education, has found themselves somewhere near the middle to the bottom of the pack.
Right. Right, so you had that example, and then you had obviously what happened in Kansas with Sam Brownback, and how, you know, teachers there were like starving, and you know, the populace finally revolted, and it, you know, it also impacted Florida. So under Rick Scott, and now under DeSantis, who finally actually pushed for a pay increase, but not a very big pay increase, but under Rick Scott, you know, it was very difficult for teachers, and it really made it difficult for anyone there in that state to make it, even after being a teacher for 10, 20 years. And that was kind of like the point of the story, I think, was that not only to address the crisis of teachers not being paid well and that their wages have remained stagnant, but to look for a place like, you know, Florida, which is considered, you know, not a poor state by any measure, and yet that they pay their teachers so poorly. I mean, worse than what you'd think of in Mississippi or Alabama. You know, states that you think of as poverty stricken.
I was looking at the story, and I was going, and I stopped it. I reread the story a couple of times because you put the starting number of this guy somewhere. What was it, it was like $9,000 or $10,000 or something?
Yeah. I mean, it's comparable to that. I don't have it in front of me, but it was something along those lines. And that they have, you know, the increase, it's barely increased. So he, you know, he's been there teaching for a few years and hasn't really seen much of an increase. And the other woman in the story, Marianne, she has been teaching. She used to teach up in Vermont, where in the 70s she could afford a nice home and a nice life with her family. And now she's in Florida and she's like, you know, in her 60s and has to work extra jobs and is being paid comparably, you know, less than what she was making in Vermont 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a shame.
That is a shame.
More than a shame. It's outrageous.
And here's the thing. there are a lot of workers out there who are going, well, because I just saw it. I apologize. I was looking at the wrong number. In Florida, you've got that they rank 30th in the nation with an average starting salary just over $38,000. You look at the average working person in this country who hasn't seen a raise in 40 years, really. Their standard of living has actually gone backwards. And what's been done masterfully to us is you've seen people pitted against one another. You know, the taxpayers have to pay their salaries, so we're gonna squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. So that means the teachers don't get raises. Education takes a hit. It's this snowballing downward of standard of living for everybody. It's kind of like the Hunger Games, but at the top, you still got the Bezoses and the Bloombergs and the billionaire class who've walked away quite handsomely.
Right, and that's one thing that we're reporting actually this week. I'm reporting on this week and next week is, I mean, some of the increases that have happened, like in the last 6 months, 7 months, there have been some increases because of, you know, the supply and demand and the workforce. And you've seen like low-end workers, cafeteria workers, restaurant chefs, and waiters and busboys and such, and grocery store workers get increases. And, you know, sometimes dramatic increases. And yet, those have all been kind of wiped out because of inflation. So the cost of living has wiped out a lot of those gains. And even if there wasn't that inflation that, you know, basically makes those wage increases negligible to some extent, even if that wasn't there, it still doesn't really make up for the historical lack of wage increases, where these people who are making, I mean, I was just talking to a union rep in L.A., talking about how the workers there, I think retail workers are making, like, they get about $24, or the hotel maids and the housekeepers get about $24, now $25 an hour. And that was a big increase to fight for that. And that those people, if you look at that sector, their wages have remained so low over the last 20, 30 years, they should be at a much higher level, like either in the 30s or 40s per hour.
Yeah.
And they're not. So these piecemeal increases are kind of lauded by the press, I hate to say it, and by, of course, conservatives then use that to say, well, look, who needs minimum wage increases? Because, you know, the private sector is already giving these people salary increases and their markets, you know, functioning effectively.
Yeah, see, I go the other way with that. I go, you know, we're in a moment right now where, you know, okay, everybody's about $15 an hour. Why not raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour? Because it's probably not going to go back. And the only ones that are going to try and claw it back are the most unscrupulous, low-wage employers that we really shouldn't want to begin with.
Right. That's absolutely true. And that's not really a way to, you know, to be at the whims of the market, which is, of course, going to, like, always look for the lowest wage they can attract somebody. And finally, now they have a situation where people are being able to be selective and say, you know what, that job I was doing stocking shelves, that sucks. I'm gonna look for something better. And that's good. Except you have to worry about inflation, which luckily is going down a little bit, you know, in recent weeks. It's partly going to make up for the lack of, pay increases over the last 30 years. So there's still a long way to go. You just hope that the increases are more than expected, and there's enough of those over the next 10 years to get to a level where it's somewhat fair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reality is I think it was the Economic Policy Institute who came out with a study this week that said since 1978, our CEO class has seen their pay rise 1,322%, while the typical worker, people like you and me, just about 18% over that period.
Right.
And you see this great unleveling where, you know, this giant sucking sound, to use a Ross Perot frame, of money out of our pocket to theirs. And there's got to be something there's got to be a rubber band that snaps back and goes, enough already. Well, we've got to take some of that back and turn the tide.
I think you see some of that. There is a little bit of, you know, there is a bit of populism, even on the right, where there is a little bit of, all of a sudden, there's a realization, like, things are out of whack. And, I mean, I think of myself, I mean, like, since, I think 10, 15 years ago, part of me was kind of like, you know what, it doesn't really matter if people make their billions, whatever. It sounds crazy, but if you want to pay Bezos that much, that's fine. As long as the working people get good wages. And yet, now I've realized, just through, you know, learning and researching it, that they're interconnected.
Yep.
So, of course, the reason that Bezos is getting so much is because so much is being transferred and sucked away from working people, from wages that they're not getting, from benefits they're not getting, that are all of a sudden being transferred over to the business class into Wall Street.
Absolutely.
And these companies.
And, you know, the reality is, you know, I think it was EPI who said it, you know, back in 89, you know, right around the time when I started working, the average CEO pay was 61 to 1. Back in the 60s, right. It was 20 to 1. We're now at 351 to 1. You know,
which is stunning.
It's stunning. I mean, the level of greed is stunning. And I'm glad to see that there are a number of strikes going on. I think we need more strikes. I'm a supporter of workers going on strike because it shows that there are some options out there. Because, look, that's obscene. And that's a result of not having a strong, vibrant labor movement to hold these people accountable.
Right. And you start to see, I mean, obviously, even having an election in Alabama for Amazon and that warehouse was a big deal. And even though they lost, now having the NLRB, you know, that hearing officer basically say, go back and do it again, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That was a big moment. That actually could end up, you know, changing the results. That's possible. But even at the very least, I think it gives encouragement to other workers who wouldn't even have considered trying to organize that now they can do it.
Yeah, I'm still hoping they go, no, we're not going to run another election. We're imposing union recognition on there. You start bargaining.
Oh, right.
That's the right move right there.
But wouldn't it be better, Rick, if they just did an election and they won?
They're not going to win.
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm going to go on a limb here, and I'm going to say that there's not one person left in that Amazon facility who signed a card.
That's possible. I mean, that's probably a good guess.
Because they've got they say during the 150% turnover?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's true.
To me, at some point, you got to go, no, you've gamed the system long enough. You've threatened. You've intimidated. You've created this environment of intimidation. We're going to impose this. You got to start bargaining. Because after all, Alabama's a right-to-work state. People don't even have to join.
Right.
And for Amazon to spend $200 million to deny them that is crazy. Just absolutely crazy. But Marcus, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do over there at Capital in Maine.
Thank you.
Keep it up. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Yes, definitely. I will hopefully make it a regular thing. I love talking to you, Rick.
Outstanding.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much, Marcus. But no, I mean, the fact that they spent that kind of money, absolutely insane. It's just crazy. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1881. That was the day the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners passed their first constitution at a meeting in Chicago. The meeting was organized by Peter J. McGuire. McGuire grew up on the Lower East Side of New York City. He became a well-known labor speaker and is credited with helping to found the Labor Day holiday. Representatives from 11 cities answered McGuire's call and came to Chicago. For 4 days, they debated and discussed their vision for a new union. In the end, they completed a constitution and general structure. They nominated McGuire as their first general secretary. At its founding, the new union had just over 2,000 members. It grew slowly, not even reaching 6,000 by 1885. Yet the union leaders remained determined. McGuire logged 18-hour days traveling to different cities, speaking, writing, and promoting the union cause. Then, in 1886, came the nationwide push for the 8-hour workday. On May 1st, carpenters marched in the streets with fellow workers in major cities across the nation. By 1890, union membership had grown to more than 50,000. By the time of the Carpenters' Convention in 1914, held in Indianapolis, the union boasted more than 261,000 members. The union's general secretary addressed the convention that day by looking back on what had been accomplished. He said, "Our organization today is something to be proud of. They never imagined for a moment that they would have an organization such as we have and accomplish as much as we have accomplished. Today, the Brotherhood includes more than 500,000 members.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.